This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
You know, you just shake your head sometimes. You just do. Because there's so much information that's coming in the Nancy Guthrie case from so many different places. And the places that should be solid sources sometimes are, sometimes aren't. Sometimes this means something, sometimes that means something. At the end of the day, an 84-year-old grandmother with a heart condition was taken out of her own home in the dead of night. 5 months later, no body, no arrest, no answer. Harvey Levin offered to pay the Bitcoin ransom himself and track the money on camera. The FBI, he says, ghosted him for a month and told him to stand down because they're making progress. Meanwhile, today, this morning, this is new, Sheriff Nanos decided to get up, have a cup of coffee, and go on local radio and tell people, quote, I think... This is the quote, quote, I think, dot, 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 the FBI has done a number of arrests for fake ransom notes. He thinks the sheriff running this investigation isn't sure what the FBI is doing on his own case. That's where we're beginning this week. Robin Dree, retired FBI special agent, former chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, is with us to help us break all of this down. And I think the headline this morning is Nanos. And I don't know if it's a headline. And I don't like jumping onto things that we don't know a lot about. But it is the story. He is an official with power in this case saying that I think the FBI has done a number of arrests for false or fake ransom notes. He thinks. Robin, what's your read on that?
That's something you just shouldn't say.
Yes. Yes.
You know, to think, you know, when you, it's nothing but a caveat. You know, it's a qualifier for, you know, it's a qualifier.
It
He's
is.
Qualifying things that are coming out of his mouth. In other words, it's given him the ability to backtrack it if it's not true. If you're in a position of knowledge, authority, leadership on an investigation, any investigation, the last thing you do is present possibilities to an audience. You present facts, data, and details to an audience. I mean, here's an example. So when my team, when we would do a behavioral assessment for a case agent in the field across the country, we did hundreds a year. And here's what we would do. We would go into the field office. We'd get all the materials ahead of time that we possibly could from the case agent, from language specialists, from subpoenas, FISAs, all this thing. I'd spread it to my team. So we'd take on all this knowledge, kind of like what we do on the show here, taking all the facts, data, and details. Then we go on site. We talk to the case agent themselves and any other experts they want to bring in to tell us about the individual we're going to be interacting with or creating a strategy around. And then the most important thing happens. We kick the case agent out of the room while we deliberate. Because when we deliberate, we're going to say things like, I think. But you don't want to say that in front of the person who's actually receiving the information, because they'll lock onto something that may or may not be true. And that when that happens, they'll go down rabbit holes that go nowhere. They'll get sidetracked over here. They'll see something shiny over here. When you present to the consumer of your information, you have to be succinct, you have to be precise, you have to be accurate, and you have to be truthful. And so when you come out and give statements like, I think, you created more chaos in the world, so not less.
I mean, it's really par for the course with this. I'm not shocked by this statement. It certainly makes a headline. What just gets me about it is the seeming aloofness to it, that saying these words out loud are going to have an effect. He said from the get-go, I'm not used to people taking my words seriously, or something of that nature. Well, maybe 6 months into this shit show, you should be. Maybe at this point, there's cause and effect to the things that come out of that hole in your head and the way that people react to them. And when you're talking about this, this is real life. This is a woman who is missing, who's probably dead, who has a family, who he is grieving, who's being accused of being involved. They're going through their own hell, and you're just kind of like, well, I think. How about you just shut the F up if you got nothing to say? I mean, that might be the best route. I don't know. Call me crazy.
I agree. Well, you know, to me, it's very disrespectful, and it's arrogant.
Yeah.
I don't care how many reps you have. I had 22 years with the FBI before I retired, and then I retired in 2018. I've been doing commentary for a long time now with you and other shows and on TV. The most important thing you can do is show respect to the people you're communicating with, understanding what they expect to hear from you, and prep. Yeah, every single time. I mean, I worked with case agents inside the Bureau that had been in the Bureau for 25 years, 30 years. When we were consulting, providing information and feedback, I don't care what it was. Everything we did, we prepped and we strategized how to present the information to others. Even though we had experience, we never, ever shot from the hip. We strategized as a team. What's a unified message we're going to put forward? And here was another rule we had. We would have one speaker that represented the team when we're presenting our thoughts and opinions to consider. That's how we framed it. And we had one voice. If there was a dissenting voice on our team, you weren't allowed to say anything unless you asked permission and say, listen, Robin, I have another thought on this based on this. Would you mind if I interject that, or should we hold it to the end? Because we become extremely professional and respectful of the process so that we don't have mishaps like this. There is never, I don't care how expert you think you are, don't shoot from the hip when people aren't expecting it. Now, you can caveat things that, listen, just off the top of my head, I haven't given this a lot of thought. In other words, you should caveat things that you haven't given thought to if you're going to shoot from the hip. But when you shoot from the hip like that, I find it disrespectful and definitely arrogant, because he doesn't think he needs to contemplate anything before he says it.
And I mean, let's examine what he would know for a moment. There's two totally different agencies, obviously. This is the Pima County Sheriff's Department, and then you have the FBI. Two totally different investigations going on, you know, simultaneous, but FBI is in the lead with this now. Would he know if they're arresting people? If the FBI is honing in, we know the one that was arrested early on, but we don't know of anyone else publicly other than Nanos uttering this out loud. Would he have that knowledge? And because to me, it's like it's either they have or they haven't. What do you mean you think? Like, were you not paying attention when the FBI, you're like busy playing on your phone while you're on a conference call? Like, I think they mentioned something about arresting other people. Or is it just is he just speculating as if he's now a spectator and he doesn't hold the title of Pima County Sheriff?
Well, those words are speculation words. They're not definitive words. Like, yeah. He didn't say they have made arrests. He said, I think they made arrests. And that's the difference there. Now, would he know? If he wanted to know, he would. Because, you know, it really depends on the relationship that both Pima County and the FBI have right now. Because there's a huge amount of professional courtesy that goes back and forth between law enforcement. I mean, if you have a good, healthy relationship with the people you're working with, especially on a case like this, if someone's going to make an arrest related to your case, even though it's not going to impact, you know, certain other things, yeah, you notify the person you've been working with. You know, whether it's an official task force or an ad hoc task force or just a working collaboration, working group on this crime, that's what you do. You have collaboration and you share information, you share details, and you share it with the lead investigator, not necessarily him. And that's where it's also interesting too, because like, so say I'm on the FBI side, I'm leading the FBI team on the Nancy Guthrie investigation. And I now know, first of all, you typically notify people that have any kind of tendril on this, that you're about to make arrest on this. And unless you've been dictated by headquarters, not because they've known to have leaks. I've had that before too. I mean, I remember right after 9/11 in New York City, I'll never get this. Oh my gosh. We got a lead to drive out to this hotel that we knew one of the hijackers had stayed at in New York prior to this. Mm-hmm. I had gotten this lead. I hop in a car. I'm in there with an NYPD guy and a couple other agency people heading out there. We had just gotten this lead in, and I hear the NYPD guy talking to his sergeant on the phone. He hangs up the phone with a sergeant. 3 seconds later, we're listening to the AM radio on the way out. It's being reported on the news exactly what was just said. I was like, holy shit. In those cases, your bosses then tell you, don't share this because it goes blah.
Yeah.
But typically, that collaborative environment that's created by case agents investigators, they will share information like that because it's important for the investigation, so sure. You don't step on each other's toes. And that's why him saying, I think, No, he should know. he should know. I'm kind of befuddled by this.
Yeah, it just, it doesn't seem like a I think type statement to make. But I mean, I guess enough on that. It's certainly an interesting headline. It's an interesting statement that was made. Maybe he'll clarify himself. Maybe he won't. I don't know if he's just talking like in general about the FBI, the way he spoke of like, yes, they've arrested people who've made fake notes in other cases. None of it was caveated. That's what makes it so confusing. It's like, well, are they honing in on more? So, I don't know. I don't know.
If you understand him and the data points he's given us, it's part of his arc. His arc is he talks to everyone, news, media, and probably his family and friends is exactly the same. He doesn't have a filter for understanding where he's at, his audience, and who he needs to be communicating effectively with. I think he's got one mode of communication, which makes him extremely predictable and which is makes him chaos.
Which is pretty much what he admitted from the day one of I'm not used to people taking my words seriously. That's the last thing I think any sheriff should ever have come out of his mouth, but okay. Let's talk about the ransom notes a little bit because there seems to be a lot of noise out there on it. And I'm going to do my best to try and break this down a little bit. Coffin Daffer did a piece on this on her channel the other day over the weekend, Break the Case. Check that out too, because she really tries to help you understand, because it is very confusing. You got the first two notes that went to TMZ, that went to local TV stations. They're a little bit different, but from what we understand, and this is the best I can put it, is that those were likely from the same people, the first two notes. Now, there in total might have been about four or five notes, but some to TMZ, some to local TV, but essentially the same message across the board to different outlets, essentially communicating the same sort of things. And also the same sort of things about she's dead. There's some that say they're sorry. There's some that say that she's not. So you got all that. Then you have this other string of emails that have come in. We don't know if they're connected to the first two because we do not know if they are the same IP addresses. I want to be clear as day about that. There is no one out there that knows that these are the same IP addresses other than law enforcement. That has never been publicly stated, despite what you may hear on the internets or other shows. We do not know that. We don't know if it's the same IPs. And so there's that. So we don't know if they're coming from the same people. But there has certainly been a string of more notes that have been coming in to TMZ that do share the same IP, not necessarily the original IP from those first two that Savannah and her family seem to take seriously. And this new string has been a pattern. But patterns don't always equal promise. They don't always equal that we're going to get somewhere. Some tend to be coming from predators who are looking for a payday more than anything else. Just because there's a pattern doesn't mean it's all that legit. And there's been quite a few communications with Harvey at TMZ, and Harvey's been publicizing them and talking about them, and has even offered to pay the Bitcoin on it. And the FBI told him to pull back. What is your take on that continued communication back and forth? And this is a communication that I'm talking about that has the device in it. They claim they have video of Nancy Guthrie and the kidnapper on this device in a location that they'll tell you where it's at for a Bitcoin. It's a device. It's not even just a picture. It's a device. Imagine the cornucopia of information on a device. What's your take on that second string of pattern emails that Harvey is talking about at TMZ?
Maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe. So there's a few things that I'd be considering right now as the investigator. If I'm actually making a lot of progress, because again, we do not know what's going on behind the scenes with the actual investigators. We're just getting all the conjecture noise that was being filtered out or invented outside. Who knows? So if they're actually getting closer and doing, you know, in the glass half full, getting closer to seeing who this is and locking in, you know, the potential to ignore that is high. It might be so incongruent with the other data that they're getting in, saying that's just nothing but BS, so we're not going to pay attention to it or put it under investigation for interfering with law enforcement investigation. So that's another charge I could bring up on folks like that. Or they say, well, this might be legit. And because we're not getting anything officially on this, on whether they think it's legit or not, it's really, really hard to say. All I know is that everything we're seeing, that included, the probability of it being related is really slim. It's just slim.
And it gets a little more ridiculous as the days go on. One of the later notes that we've understood from what Harvey has said, and I'm not saying anything bad about Harvey here, he's just reiterating the information that he's getting, is that the Bitcoin wallet, the original, is not accessible. So we need to go to a different wallet now.
Yep.
Yeah, that doesn't seem like it might be a different person or anything. Like, that's not the right wallet. I'm the same person, but I can't get into that one anymore. So why don't you put the money over here? Because I'm certainly the same person. I mean, it's just, that is that's a red flag, I think, number one. But number two, the idea that there's this device out there that has the image on, and they won't, I mean, look, if you want to make the money, show them an image. Just show them a quick screen grab. You'll get your money pretty quick if someone can authenticate that. You will get your fucking money. Then
it's
do it.
Hotline. Yeah.
Yeah. But if you don't have it, you're not going to do it. This is mystery device. Now, this device, I mean, look at every case we cover here. What's the one thing that so many criminals forget about half the time? This and what it can do. The tracking on it. The apps that track you in ways you have no idea they're tracking you on. Your location data. There's so many things that if they were to find this device, if it is involved with this, it would tell them so much and probably not a lot of great things about the person who is supposedly providing this either. It seems like, as they even said, they're like putting it out on a silver platter. I mean, that would be a silver platter, quite honestly, if they have a device like that. But why go through all these hoops to get there if you truly have this piece of information? This just seems like a circus of the stars to get some information.
In my mind, the only way that this makes sense and might be legit is that if it's more than just porch guy involved, because he doesn't look like he's capable of anything, right? Because again, just pure conjecture, just looking at behaviors on a step. This does not look like a high operationally sophisticated individual.
Yeah.
But good enough not to get caught, right? People say that's fine. So in my mind, it means that there's definitely more than just him involved, maybe one other person, possibly three. If you look at a law of averages, it's two-ish top, right? And then this person would be someone that is like turned on porch guy and doesn't want anything to do with him and wants to make a buck off of it. And the way you get around it is that beforehand you buy burner phones and you just use burner phones from the same Walmart you got the stupid reflective backpack from when you do an operation. I mean, I would typically buy a pack of like five burner phones, you know, once a year for operations I was doing, so I could actually whip one out if we have something I got to maintain anonymity about or something like that. And so it could be everything contained on a burner phone that someone's turned on. Because remember, one of the theories we have on this, if something's going to break, it's going to be from someone. If there's one more person than just porch guy involved, it's going to be someone inside a circle that says, screw that, I'm done, I want some cash. That, to me, would be possible and plausible, but that's the only way.
Why do you think it is, I mean, that the FBI won't just pay the one Bitcoin that that this person to TMZ is asking for? Because it's you're talking about roughly, depending on the moment, 60 to 70, 80,000 Bitcoin fluctuates of what that is actually worth. Now, because at the end of the day, it's going to lead you possibly somewhere, maybe not to Nancy's killer or kidnapper, but to somebody doing something. I mean, when we look at the sheer amount of government waste that we have with money, it seems like a drop in the bucket. And even Harvey is saying, I'll front you the money. If it's about the money, I'll pay the money. But even they're saying, nah, hold off. We might be close. Why not tickle the wire, Robin?
Well, that's the interesting question. I mean, we did a lot of operations all the time to gather intelligence, even though if we didn't think it was going to bear the outcome we're looking for, any intelligence becomes good intelligence. And by tickling the wires, you say, and paying the Bitcoin, you're going to get intelligence. You're either going to get the information that leads you to Nancy, or you're going to find out not to use this line again because this person's fraudulent. And so that gives you intelligence, and it's at a pretty low cost comparatively with everything, right? Which then gives me the conclusion, well, they're not doing it. And all these people willing to pay for this. I mean, hell, you could set up a GoFundMe within 5 seconds to have enough money in it based on a notoriety of this, right? I mean, it would cost everyone like nothing to do this, which says to me that someone inside of law enforcement is saying, don't do it because we don't need to do it.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I can, that's the only reason I can see not to do it.
There's been a lot of talk in the last week about from various people, and it's all conjecture. Howard Bloom thinks, according to his sources, that they're it's a dead end right now, that they're not really finding much, that there's not enough, that they're not being led anywhere of any sort of meaning. Maureen O'Connell last week made a statement on Megan's show about feeling like maybe they're 75%, feeling like it. I was on Nancy Grace this morning with Maureen. Maureen had said that she doesn't believe any of these notes are real. Pretty much that was the consensus of everybody. You'll see it tonight on Nancy Grace. But it's that I find interesting because Maureen made that statement last week. Everybody was talking about it. We talked about it. Is there a world here where all of these notes, they do lead absolutely nowhere? They are not anything to do with Nancy's disappearance, but they are getting close, but maybe they are, from her take last week, Maureen's take of being 75% on the right path here of getting close to this. Could that exist where all this is just noise out in the ether and it doesn't really matter to the actual investigation?
Yeah, I think that's so. And I misspoke, I think, because before I said it's either that they don't need the intelligence or they're getting close.
Yeah.
Or I forgot to mention, the first thing you and I said on our show when this first broke is that I at the very get-go said the probability of this being a ransom note is slim to none, just because it's so far to the norm that this is not the way it's normally done. In every single other case, it's not been done this way. So if that's the other reason that they're not responding, because they all now believe that every single note's complete bunch of BS. And I know that you have the ones they had inside knowledge of at the house, the color, where she put the eye on the Apple Watch, what she's wearing. Okay, but I don't know who assessed that. That's the problem, is that we hear these things and it gets spread around an Ethernet, but you have I don't have any idea the veracity of what I'm, and that's where the frustration is. I don't know the veracity of the information and the sourcing of the original sourcing of it, so to give it any kind of weight of credibility or not. And at the very onset, I thought the probability personally, and I'm always open to change. That's why I live in the world of maybe, because as more data comes in, I love flexing on the fly. I enjoy the mental gymnastics of bringing more data and shifting what I think as more accurate information comes in. But at the very beginning, based on my research, based on past cases, just didn't fit what happens. But I don't know. But again, which the behavior we're seeing today kind of confirms that, if it's one of those options that we saw. Either they're getting really close and they don't need it, or they think it's complete bunk to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, if anything, maybe it will bring out opportunists and they can bust them at the very least. I guess my conjecture, my feeling, I don't know the answer to this, but I'm curious to get your thoughts. At this level in this case, we're this far in, there's already been this pattern of gazillions of notes coming in. Are there far more notes coming in to places than we're aware of, and only certain ones seem to be making the cut to what's getting out there publicly? I know you know people who've received notes that no one knows about yet, and probably never will, because they don't lead anywhere. I'm just wondering, how many opportunists do you think are out there trying to get some money out of this that are not very sophisticated? They're not even really thinking about how their verbiage is and their letters. Ransom notes saying USD. There was one that I believe was reported to call Savannah Guthrie Samantha. There's all these little things. I mean, this just seems like a cornucopia of opportunists trying to trying to get some attention here, trying to get some money. How difficult is that from an investigative standpoint then to say, who's legit? Because it's not like anyone's going to be like, oh, yes, this IP, that goes to that house. And we know that's where a lot of killers tend to live. I mean, it's how do you decipher all of that noise?
Yeah, there's a lot of chaos and a lot of noise. And I guarantee there's tons coming in or have come in at least, and if not more. Whether they're going for money or notoriety, criminal notoriety is a great motivation with a lot of human beings in cases like this. And so here's what I'm hoping at this point of investigation, because this is what typically happens, as you've narrowed the field of what you're looking at, and if Maureen's correct and they're getting really closer here, 75%, as she said, or just glasses half full, as I say,
yeah.
That helps you filter out this riffraff. Because if you're looking at, because I always use my visuals, if you've narrowed your scope, you've had 40, 50,000 leads, whatever you had, and you brought those all down to right around in here. And you're right around in here, and where you know IP addresses that were actually involved with it, or maybe they weren't involved at all. You know, based on what you've done investigatively, you're right in this zone right here. If you see something, a noise coming from out here, out here. In other words, all the notes that aren't fitting in that filter you've created, you're not paying attention. Are you going to have to farm one out to chase them down because we cover every lead? Yes, but it's get assigned to the agent that just got assigned the field office in his first week. That's typically how these things get filtered down.
It's going to be real.
It's a lot. It's a lot of bandwidth.
It's a lot of bandwidth. There's a lot of noise. There's only so many people that can run all these things down. And it certainly doesn't feel like it helps anything when you get statements out there like, I think. Okay. Thank you for your thoughts today.
And that happens with us. I mean, I get a lot of text messages through all my social media with people with great theories, great this, send me photos of things. I mean, it's and you want to respond, but at the same time, you really can't, because you got to filter these things down, because people come up with some wild things that sound really, really good. Remember, human beings are the only organism on this planet that see and create patterns where they don't necessarily exist. And most of the time, they don't. And so if you want to see something happen the way you want it to happen, or you think you've locked on to what it actually is, you'll start seeing confirmation bias all over the place that kind of zero it in, and then, blah, there it is. That's what you have to filter through.
And I think there's so much of that going on in this case of confirmation bias, because people want to believe that where they're going with it is going to lead somewhere.
And that they're right.
And it's not that anybody wants to take, I mean, I'm sure some people want to take people down wrong paths for clicks, but I don't think most people have that intent. It's just people dig in, they feel solid on what they believe, and they go down the path of confirmation bias. And before you know it, you're getting a phone out of a mailbox somewhere after you paid a Bitcoin, and you got a picture of Nancy Guthrie on an island with her arm around Tupac and JFK. And it's like, oh, well, that's not quite what we thought we were going to find here. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in. And no, there's no picture, although I'm sure there will be after this. Your thoughts on Substack and YouTube, the links are in the description. Let's go over to another case that we are continuing to follow here, and taking your comments from YouTube and Facebook and internet. We're going to try and answer some of them today. And if you got some on these cases too, please do drop them in the comments section, and we'll try to get to them. Half of the comments treat the schizophrenia diagnosis here in the Nick Reiner case as the end all be all of it. And like, well, that. That does it. End of day. He's sick. Other people survive just fine with this and don't go out and do these horrible, horrible acts. At the end of the day, that is probably going to be a big piece that is argued in court in terms of competency for Nick Reiner. But who knows? We are still very far away from an actual court date. Joining me to discuss, Robin Drake, retired FBI Special Agency for the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about the diagnosis. There are millions of people manage this illness, never touch anybody. At what point does, you know, he was sick stop being the explanation and start being a way to stop thinking about this? You're using it as a crutch or an excuse. How do you delineate into that gray area of, well, how much of this is the disease and how much of this is just him as a shitty person?
Yeah, I think it's all of it. I mean, he's just a cocktail of crazy stupid.
Yeah.
I think the broken brain part of him with schizophrenia, if that's what he's diagnosed with, is a part of the whole. Because like you said, I mean, you do the research on it, you know, schizophrenics tend to not be violent. Mm-hmm. But he's got escalating behaviors of violence and anger. He's got drug issue problems. He's got medications surrounding depression. It's a cocktail of really crazy because when you put all that together in a brain soup, you don't know what's going to come out. And when you have triggers that keep escalating over time, you have parents that are doing their best, but at the same time, doing their best means that they're enabling the living shit out of him for a period of time and forever by thinking they can keep normalizing that broken brain by bringing him to people's parties that he really shouldn't be going interacting with human beings right now. And then when he himself, the main thing going on with him, besides all the cocktail of crazy, is he sees himself as a victim. And when you put yourself in the victim, the world's out to get me mode, everyone in your environment is going to trigger you. And then if you have no emotional regulations towards violence, anger, and frustration, and you have no guardrails against acting out, there you go.
Do you think that this is the motive, the money, that at the end of the day, obviously, you know, going and killing them is not going to produce you getting money and freedom at the same time. Those two truths can't be really held together. But in a broken brain, it might be like, well, if I just get rid of them, then I'll get the money. But I do wonder, because if we go back to he was supposed to get all that money, the $1.5 million, I believe, on his 30th birthday. That didn't happen. We get to his 31st. They're all out to dinner. There's a picture of them together. And then obviously life continues on and things go absolutely haywire. You don't need to prove motive in court. But when we're trying to examine what the hell happened here, do you think it is as clear cut at the end of the day as he wanted his money and he was really mad about it, and this is how he acted out, not necessarily as a lever to get it, but just as a petulant adult child as an adult, basically with a child's brain, acting out to get that money?
Maybe. And what I say by that is it kind of goes to the adage, if someone's out to do harm to another human being, whether they have access to a weapon, a knife, or their fist or a vehicle, they're going to do harm because they're escalating towards that. And there's lots of triggering events along the way. I think him not getting his trust, him not getting his money and wanting his money as a petulant child, as you said, was an excuse that he was using potentially for his abhorrent behavior that he was having. So whether he actually, I mean, think about this. Based on what we know of him from social media, from interactions, interviews, and statements by other people, can you actually imagine a world if he had gotten his trust that he would have had different behavior? No. He would have been on a bigger drug bender for many more years. And would he have gotten violent eventually when that money ran out? Yep. It might have delayed it, but until he actually hits some sort of bottom, which apparently if you've been in rehab that many times, you're bottomless. And so I just think it was a rationalization for what it was inevitable to happen anyway if he's living in that home.
Is that the reality for a lot of people that they're, I mean, everybody, when you hit rock bottom, you know, it's a wake-up call. Is there a rock bottom for everybody? Or is there, is Nick one of those where there is no, I mean, the rock bottom, you're in a casket. That's the rock bottom.
Yeah.
Because there's no, you're never going to have that moment of clarity of like, shit, I really, something needs to change here. And if you got something going on mentally, I mean, maybe you're not capable of ever recognizing you're at rock bottom. He even said in some interviews when they were doing the movie about, you know, what was rock bottom for you? And he's like, I never really hit rock bottom.
Yeah, means that he was never really was ready for rehab to begin with. I mean, I followed alcoholism and the effects of alcoholism and addiction and drug addicts for many, many years. And there are a lot of tragic events. I mean, until the 12-step program came about by the founders in the 20s and 30s, there was no cure, and there's not even a cure. There's a counseling way out of it, and you have to be willing. You have to hit that point in your life where you can start taking accountability. So remember, the main trigger that he lacks so far, and what keeps anyone from getting on a road to recovery, and again, his mental state, his mental illness, whatever it is, could be exasperating it, obviously it is when you shift from being a victim in your mind to, I am the only one that can do something to fix this. Mm-hmm. Once that shift happens and you just let go, only then can you actually start to mend and heal. But again, that is his addiction problems is one part of the chaos soup that's going on in that brain, and he might be incapable of it. And even people that aren't suffering from mental illness as well as addiction, they'll never hit it. I mean, addiction grabs that brain so severely and puts it in a stranglehold. So had he gotten, so again, I'll go back to the conjecture side, had he actually gotten his trust and gotten that money, I'm not saying what happened to the Reiners was inevitable. What was either going to happen was he was going to escalate the violence towards others inevitably or kill himself. Not by suicide necessarily, although that was higher potential as well with all these kind of things going on, but he would have overdosed at some point as well, which I'm kind of shocked he didn't.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we don't know all, you know, and we obviously don't know everything that went on behind the scenes in that life. I wonder, I mean, I'd be very surprised if there had not been some moments where it was that close. But
yeah,
who knows? I mean, who knows? One of the comments that we see a lot of, and it's kind of summarizes many of them, years of botched psychiatric care. Making him a victim. And it somewhat lands because, you know, every juror's been let down by a doctor. Easy to call, you know, the lawyer's trick here, but is there a real argument underneath it of this is a person who was in a lot of programs over and over and over. Now, if he chose to participate, that's another thing. But it's not like the programs weren't there. But obviously, you need to participate in your own recovery. And if you don't, it's not going to work. Is that an argument? Is that an argument that he can make, especially too when there is track record and there are people who were in recovery with him? Some of them have emailed this show off the air and I've talked to them about this of Nick from many of the encounters that I've heard of wasn't super participatory in the recovery. How is that going to weigh in your opinion with a jury if they hear, okay, he had a lot of chances, he's mentally ill? I mean, could it work in his favor of like, see, nothing worked for him? Or can it be, see, he didn't try?
Yeah, I think it screws him. I mean, yeah. It's hard to have a sympathetic jury when your parents had as much money, resources, and willingness an engagement with getting him the absolute best therapy, best counseling, best everything that money could buy. I mean, they mm-hmm. poured their heart and souls into trying to save him. But again, you know, you can lead a horse to water, but first you got to make him thirsty. Nick was never thirsty.
I think that's, that's the reality of it.
He didn't. So some people are addicted to the chaos that they create in the world around them. Not just the drugs, not just anything. They're addicted to being a victim. And it gives them a sense of purpose to feel that center of attention. And he was always the center of someone's attention. That is a huge motivator as well. You know, if your only dopamine hits that you're getting in life and that brain of yours is coming from drugs, from whatever, you know, from alcohol and from the attention you're getting, negative attention included, why wouldn't you keep going with it?
Yeah. I mean, if you just keep getting confirmation that this is working for you, because it is working for him, it's keeping him going.
He's living in his mind. He's living the life. He's living for free. He doesn't have to work. He's got a trust fund. He gets to go to cushy rehab places whenever someone decides he has to go. And he doesn't really have to do it because he just has to be dry for a couple months and they'll let him out again. And then he'll start all over again, because why wouldn't he? Because there's zero consequence he's faced for. And again, it's not, and I'm not victim blaming at all on this, you know, for the people, you know, the Reiners that suffered this or anyone in his circle. This person was just so broken, as we've said on other shows before. He should be locked away. People like this got to be locked away. There's no fixing that kind of broken.
And that's something we wrestle with, you know, in the bigger picture on something like this. Is it opens people's eyes to just how broken our system is for this. I mean, he was in the conservatorship for a year, but the way California's conservatorship, and if you've missed this, I mean, go back a hand, like many of videos, and we did several on this, of how screwed up the system is, where basically you're in the conservatorship and the state immediately is trying to find every which way to get that person out of the conservatorship, the one thing that is keeping them safe and alive. It's like, we want to get you there, and then once you're there, we're going to pretend that you don't need it. And I mean, it is a broken system. Without a doubt, this is a broken system. But at what point does accountability come into play versus just an argument that the system is busted and it was not able to fix you? But some people, they are not able to fix themselves.
Well, you know,
and clearly, even loved ones aren't able to fix them.
And it's interesting thinking about systems. When systems typically start, they're started with the greatest of intentions. And actually, a lot of times, they're started very well. Mm-hmm. What happens is human beings have this amazing ability to take advantage of every single system and corrupting it. And that's why it's got to be amended. And once systems that were put in place that were actually working get amended because you have people fraudulently taking advantage of a system or abusing a system for their own personal gain, it totally screws up the system. So they all go bad.
Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube on the Reiner case. We'd love for you to weigh in. One more here this morning. Alec Murdaugh convicted of shooting his wife Maggie and son Paul beside the dog kennels on the family's South Carolina farm and sentenced to life. And the state Supreme Court threw it out, ruling that the court clerk had tampered with the jury, the same clerk who later pled guilty to charges tied to the tell-all book she wrote about the trial. Now, Murdaugh gets his do-over, and his lawyers are demanding new testing on an unknown man's DNA under Maggie's fingernails. The comments are lighting up about this. So I want to go into this, and I think we touched on it a little bit last week, but I think because so many people are jumping into this one, and it makes for a great headline, unknown male DNA underneath her fingertips. Robin, how crazy is that? Or not?
Eh. <You know>. So, so I think the biggest argument, people love DNA. So understandably, that gets a lot of weight because everyone thinks, because everyone watches Criminal Minds and everything, that DNA is the end all be all, can solve all crimes. And if you just had DNA, there'd be no crime in the world, or we'd solve every crime out there. But in this case, from what I understand, there was no struggle. And so the DNA that she has under her fingernails didn't come from the crime scene itself. It probably came from something else. Is that a reason not to test it? No, I think it's a reason to test it because if they can identify who the DNA came from, it's one more interview to do. But the likelihood of them already having interviewed someone that who this DNA that is pretty high, just because thorough investigation, everyone in her circle has been interviewed and at least one degree of separation from them should have also been interviewed, especially when it's got the case has this kind of notoriety. So is it a waste of time? No, I don't think anything like that's a waste of time, but is it going to go somewhere? Most likely not.
Well, I mean, reasonable doubt is what they're going for. And if you can throw into the mix that there's somebody else's DNA underneath someone's fingernails, without context, a juror might go, wow, well, why, what is this? But then I ran the stats the other day, and it's rather
did the Robin.
Yes, I did. We all have unknown DNA underneath our fingernails every day of our lives, and it doesn't mean that's because someone tried to murder us or we were in a struggle or any. Go to the grocery store, buy a bunch of stuff. You're going to have other people's DNA on you.
There's a lot of touch DNA on us all the time.
Yeah. So why do you think? Other than it makes a lovely headline, and I guess might play to some jurors, maybe that's the answer. Then that's just flat out it. But to me, it just seems like such a simple one to debunk on cross if you're the prosecutor going, yeah, sounds neat, but here's what I just said. You know, everybody's got it on them pretty much all the time. It doesn't mean shit. What does that say to you about where they are in terms of defending Alec Murdaugh, in terms of an investigation into trying to look at a third party culprit, that they're putting weight onto this idea that is so easily just explained with conjecture?
Yeah, who knows? It reminds me very much of the Koberger case, though. I mean, she threw everything at the sink, you know, at the case, you know, including the kitchen sink, just trying to come up with all these different theories to explain why it wasn't Koberger, you know. So, but in this one, you know, I see a potential in here. It's like, hey, maybe it's a jilted lover of hers that that was the third party involved in a defense that it wasn't Alec. It was actually, you know, Maggie's, you know, jilted lover or love interest. Who knows what they're coming up with? But hey, when you don't have much to work with sometimes, I think just throwing it out there and see what sticks, maybe. But like you said, at this point, I think a lot of these things, and I think this is what Anne, what's her face, the defense attorney for Koberger.
Oh, Taylor, Anne Taylor.
Anne Taylor was doing too, is a lot of these public statements you put out there is to taint that jury pool, intentionally or unintentionally, with doubt. So why not, right?
I get it. But it's just...
And that's whether they even introduce it. They might not even introduce it. It is. I think it's very weak. But again, you don't, the court of, you know, if you throw it out to the court of public opinion and you get a lot of other people weighing in on it, you know what you got? I mean, because think about this. Can this is how my brain works. All right. So you throw something like that out there to the ether. And then you, as a lawyer, you're not paying for a consultant to give you their professional opinion of this. You got to sit back and watch guys like Bob Mata, you know, and everyone weighing in on what they think about it. And now what you have is you actually have unpaid advice that you actually threw something out there and you know whether to do it or not.
How do you think Alec wins this? And I'm not saying this like cheering him on, like I hope he wins.
Right.
But if he were to win this, do you see this being something where they put on a super detailed defense with a lot of witnesses and a lot of conjecture and a lot of confusion? Or do you just play it simple? Because when you play it simple, if you take the financial things out of it, you don't have a ton. You really don't have a ton. You have a circumstantial case, and yes, circumstantial cases can be just as damning as anything else. But you do, I hate to say it, but I mean, I do feel like you do have some levels of reasonable doubt here in this case of him being capable of doing this. I think there's other ways of looking at it. If you do psychological deep dives, I think it's explainable. I think Alec Murdaugh is a creature that can be understood when you mix all the drugs together and you get this sort of result. But it is a hard one for people to wrap their mind around, especially with how close he was to his family that is still close to him, that still is probably frustrated as shit by his antics, that this is still going on. And I know Buster made statements of he's a selfish old man, I believe, something to that extent, that he's going to put everybody through this again. Do you play it more simple this round? Because the more you add to it, does that just, in this specific case, go to the track record of Alec Murdaugh telling tall tales? And if you have less tall tales to tell, maybe you're going to end up with a very different verdict at the end of the day.
Again, I'd be more interested in what our good lawyers think about this.
Yeah.
I'm on the side of keeping it simple, because I don't think you have to get complicated to build in plausible doubt, because a lot of people hated him. He wronged a lot of people. His family wronged a lot of people. You know, whether it's boating accidents, whether it's, you know, drug deals, there's a lot of things I think they can do, or a lot of possibilities that defense can go down to build in the, you know, reasonable doubt that it was a third party that did this in retribution against Alex, because he's a very detestable person with a lot of power. And there's a lot of people out to get people like that, as Bob said last week, you know. So when you can tap into an acknowledged hatred towards someone and then put the blame on that as retribution against Alex, because he's such a family man, because you knew how much he loved his son, because they can really leverage that one, because that's the one that really gets people more than the Maggie's aspect of it, you know, that actually can build in that reasonable doubt, I would think. And so you just keep it simple, but they're going to have to kind of behaviorally zero in on the most likely out of all these different schemes he was part of, whether it was a financial scheme that went sideways, and they'll get people to testify, yeah, we hated him, or they'll have text messages, they'll have phone records, whatever they're going to have to kind of prove that someone had the level of hatred to do this to, against Alex's family in retribution against him, because they knew that would hurt him more, and then just double down on that as the reason to have that reasonable doubt.
You know, we always talk about patterns of behavior because they lead us in directions and they make sense. They validate things when you have a pattern. This is not a pattern of behavior. He has no pattern of abusing his family. Right. He has no pattern of doing anything. This is such an outlier to all of it. So, and I this will be a fascinating conversation for Bob or Eric someday.
Except one aspect of it.
But more so, like, I like this because we, like, from a juror standpoint, if we were jurors, what's going to read better to us? And I'm wondering, what do you do on the stand when you're Alec Murdaugh? Because obviously the prosecution is going to bring their litany of evidence of circumstantial evidence against Alec. They are going to be more limited in the financial stuff, but they're probably going to introduce it in some way, shape, or form. Just not a 12-hour referendum on it. Do you even address any of those things? If you're sitting in that juror box and you just had Creighton Waters lay out all of the same shit that we saw round one again. Okay. Yep. If it snows outside and you didn't see it snow and there's snow on the ground, it obviously snowed. The ice cream truck didn't blow up down the road. That's circumstantial evidence. In this case, do you even touch it? Do you even touch any of the circumstantial evidence, or do you just make a parade of the Alec Murdaugh supporters that still exist? Buster, if he's, I mean, I believe he still support, I could be wrong. It's, who knows? A lot can change in a year. His brother, John Marvin, the other ones. Do you parade the Murdaugh family up there? Because most of them are fairly likable individuals. Mm-hmm. Do you parade all of them up there one by one and just go through what a loving family man he was and don't touch the circumstantial evidence? So you hit the heartstrings of showing this is not a pattern. This would be such a deviation from his behavior. How on earth could this possibly be it? Is that the one lever you really pull on Alec Murdaugh round two to try and not have family annihilator on his track record into eternity?
You mean as defense?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think the easiest way for the defense to go on this is to, like you said, you have, except I'd be a little more transparent with the people in his life, in the sense of I would have them completely transparent, open, and honest about drug issues, his change in behavior, because when you do the research on what opioids do, actually,
he was on a, like, a enough to kill a zoo opioids.
Right.
But yeah.
But you look at how that changes behavior, decision-making, and all that, and you look at the important things he did to people. And I think Buster's a great example of what you can get a lot of people to say. I don't think my father did it, but I hate that old man. Something like that.
Yeah.
And so, because when you can cascade that on top of his, again, going on patterns of behavior, because this is an outlier for him, because he was never the main fixer. We've said this before, and that's why I think the testimony of the maid is really important, because he never did anything for himself. I think the defense on this one is like, hey, if anything, he hired someone to do this because he is incapable of doing anything for himself, because here's his pattern of behavior. He's never done anything for himself. He's always hired a fixer. He's always hired someone to do this and that and everything else. And then when you can put on top of that, the fact that, I don't know, help or hinder is the same line of thought, but the fact that, yeah, he's not capable of it, but he's an important human being. I think that throws in a reasonable doubt. Because I don't know where again, without the financial stuff and the fact that this is a deviation from his normal pattern, I don't know how the prosecution goes at him this time, again, differently. If they have to go different than they did first time with all the circumstantial, it's really, really rough. I'm so drawn on this one. I think he is such an important human being, and he was right there. I mean, all the video says he's the one. Mm-hmm. At the same time, though, that's an outlier. But if you can have someone, an expert, explain that because of the drugs he was on, decision-making process, and that's the only thing prosecution can say, well, to counter the pattern of behavior, the drugs altered his normal pattern of behavior.
How much does the investigation, the missteps in the investigation, does that help or hurt him? Because we've talked about that too. They get out there that night. It's a parade of investigators, tire tracks, driven over, people walking everywhere. I mean, it was such a compromised crime scene so quickly. that would have answered the question either way pretty quick if there was possibly other people involved, but because it was so contaminated or just not even investigated or looked at in certain areas, does that help or hurt Alec Murdaugh at the end of the day?
I think it really depends on how it's presented and how they counter it. You know, it definitely defense, you know, it can poke holes in the investigation. Like, well, it's one of the reasons why they got a retrial besides Becky Hill. You know, Bob said that there's other reasons before, but at the same time though, I say it helps defense more than it helps prosecution, no doubt.
Yeah. I think you're probably right. Your thoughts on the comp? Yeah.
Yeah. No, I was just saying it's disappointing. I'm just so glad he's convicted on the criminal, on the financial stuff, because I put this one at 50-50 on the retrial. I really do.
I did too. I mean, I think a lot of people, like Eric Bland, who I talked to the other day, who's part of the story, he was telling me, like, you know, most people didn't think he was going to get convicted. I mean, I think Alec is the one who got himself convicted at the end of the day by taking the stand. Had that not happened, probably would have been a hung jury. I think a lot of people, I think we might have been experiencing an Alec Murdaugh trial round two around now had that taken place. But
you know, it's interesting. There's always a difference between what people want to have happen and what will happen based on facts and data. Because, do I want him to be convicted again? Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Will he?
But it's a confirmation bias, too.
Critical thinking for the win. Take the data, analyze it. What, you know, reverse the optics. All these things really. And then do, you know, the most important thing is, like, I do it before anything we do. I then don't just come up with my own thoughts and opinions and ideas. After I come up with what I think, I completely research what other people are saying and thinking as well. You know, positions of authority, notoriety, experts in different fields, other behavior. I mean, I take in a lot of different data to see if it's countering mine, supporting mine. If it counters mine, I get even more curious. If it's different than my conclusion and my ideas, I don't need confirmation bias. I need people to kind of, that's what a science experiment is. It's always saying, hey, let me prove myself wrong in this, being open and curious about that. And so that's what we do in cases like this.
Yeah. Your thoughts in the comment section, Substack, YouTube, wherever you're watching. We'd love for you to weigh in. And be sure right now, if you've not already done so, hit subscribe wherever you're watching us, whether it's on YouTube, whether you're listening to us on the podcast platforms, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, you name it. Take us wherever you go. Hit subscribe on both of those so you got us in all of our reporting every single day. Do check that out. We do appreciate that. Robin's latest book, It's Not All About Me. Here it is. This is what it looks like when you're searching for it on the internet. Go check that out, or the audiobook. Leave a review on Amazon. Please. Much appreciated. All right. Until next time, for Robin, for Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.